Thank you to Interactive Brokers for bringing you this episode. And you know, world markets, they unfold in real time. And now you can trade them with IBKR Prediction Markets. Trade election, climate, and economic outcomes alongside stocks, options, and bonds, all on one integrated platform. These are simple yes or no contracts priced to reflect the market's view of probability. If your prediction is right, you'll receive $1 per contract and earn interest on your position while you're invested. IBKR Prediction Markets turn market expectations into actionable trades. Prediction contracts are not suitable for all investors. Learn more at ibkr.com/predictions.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A tongue twister of a move, Bessent's big bond blunder. Try to say that a few times fast. Bitcoin moving higher, not for the reasons that you think. And the shine is off the penny. Investors rethink their tech bets. And our guest today, one of our faves, Ross Gerber of Gerber Kawasaki. All this and much more on episode number 987 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey again, welcome to this week's edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, and this is a place where we get down and dirty, I guess, to discuss some of the things that are not usually talked about. Last week, I hope you caught that episode, that discussion in particular about NUAs, for those of you who have positions of a company stock in your 401k plan, this is a way to virtually escape taxation. Or at least, maybe not entirely during your lifetime, but lower it substantially when you retire. But you need to know how to do it. You have to understand the ways. And these are the type of things that we do and we talk about, not because, by the way, we read it or heard about it. Nope. It is because we're actively working with these type of situations with clients, with these strategies on a regular basis. Real clients, real people, just like you. Now, today I thought we would talk about what I consider a big mistake. The current Treasury Secretary making moves, taking up threats, and now he's using superlatives like his boss, and I dare see that this is actually a problem and probably one of the biggest mistakes the world has ever seen. Kind of like what he says. Now, the action that he took over the last few weeks is not showing strength or control at all, in my opinion, right? This whole idea of what he's doing is actually coming from a place where he's exposing his hand, and where he's coming from is not a place of strength, but rather a place of fear. That's the big problem right now. And this is on the heels of that supposed, remember the handwritten note that was sitting out for everybody to see, this note to buy a huge amount of yen a few weeks ago. Remember that whole thing? And it was somehow photographed and sent around. It was played up as let's send it out and sent around. And everybody was like, oh my God, look what he's going to do. He's going to buy the yen. Now, come on. Who is buying that this was a mistake? It was planned. There's no question about it. It was 100% set up to try to coax markets to do the dirty work. And if it didn't work, well, okay, who would be wiser? Now we have even more of a worrisome situation that I think is really a problem. And it revolves around the Treasury Secretary again, because the Treasury knows that the Fed has little control over the long end of the yield curve. So what do? Remember that the Fed chair said, let the markets do the work. We're not going to step in and necessarily give them all the information, but the markets need to do the work. And I said, man, you don't want to tempt the markets with that. Now, the problem is that we have the midterms coming up. And as everything, I mean, everything is political and publicized in a political manner and politicized even worse these days. The Treasury saw this as a major opportunity. So Treasury Secretary Bessent announced that they're shifting and purchasing bonds in a move that hopefully would calm markets. Because what we saw was that the 30-year bond was at the highest level it's been for how long, right? I mean, for decades. They decided they're going to do $4 billion of long-dated bonds they were going to buy. Now, everybody got this a little bit confused, by the way. They thought this was quantitative easing again. They decided to buy long-dated bonds and issue short-dated. In fact, as opposed to quantitative easing, this absolutely has no impact on the monetary supply. Now, even though the United States dollar, the U.S. dollar, USD, whatever you want to call it, dipped and people got hysterical and started buying up precious metals and crypto, the fact of the matter is what he did had no impact on the actual money supply. Now, also, when we talk about Bitcoin, let's go back to that for a second and I'll loop this in. On that subject, there was this narrative circulating that the push to get the Clarity Act passed was reason enough that crypto started moving. In fact, it's really only another political push, right? They're trying to get this through. Everybody's all excited about this. But the reason is what we're actually talking about is why we started seeing the crypto moving. Is the idea that the Treasury is stepping in and purchasing bonds in a very unusual move. And I want to be clear about this. I want to absolutely make sure we are 100% all on the same page on this. It did not work. I mean, it did for a day. But yields finished the week higher than where they began 10 years ago. And that's a problem. When you look at what's gone on right now and you look at where we are, right now where we are is again, a concerning factor on this. Because the U.S. dollar, well, it moved higher against major currencies by Friday, and equity markets pretty much ignored the higher yields for now. Bessent showed fear. The markets are like, wait, there's a reason that interest rates are where they are. The reason is that the U.S. economy is in pretty good shape. The fact of the matter is that we have $40 trillion of debt. That's a problem. Remember that number. So what does this mean for us investors? That's a big question we have to ask ourselves, right? Because I think it's probably a reality check that the current administration, well, I don't think this is something you don't know, but they'll do anything they can to make things look good for them politically, and investors will do what they do. The problem we're having right now is that it's not that the markets are getting it wrong. In fact, I dare say the markets are getting it totally right. We just passed the $40 trillion threshold. $40 trillion in U.S. debt. $40 trillion. We've amassed $40 trillion in debt as a country and showing no signs of slowing up. We've doubled the amount of debt in the past 6 years. Think about that. Since 2010, we have quadrupled the amount. So clearly markets are a little skeptical of what is happening and the ability of the Treasury to talk their way out of this one and this mess. I think the markets actually did get it right. I think what is happening right now is that in response to the fact that we did see the intent or attempt, I'll say it differently. We saw the attempt to mess around in the currency markets. We saw the intent and attempt to try to do some yield curve control in the bond markets. The epic failure of that, and Bessent is starting to look like a talker, a yapper that absolutely has no intention of doing anything that's maybe right for the country. Because if you recall, the campaign promises going back years has been, we're going to eradicate and eliminate the debt. That's not happening. It's not happening at all. In fact, quite the opposite. 30% of the debt that we've amassed over the last number of years to get to $40 trillion really has been done over the last like 6 or 7 years. That's horrifying. Markets are sniffing it out and saying, you know what? I don't think so. I don't think that's what we're going to play with. We're not going to allow you to continue to rack up debt and try to provide us with this idea that this is all for the benefit of the economy. Something's going to break somewhere. And we're seeing that yields are rising all across the world right now. And Japan is at the highest level it's been in 40 years. Inflation is still picking up there. Inflation is not settling down here. That's only there and here in both Japan and the United States. Look around the world. The same thing is going on. No wonder why people are starting to freak out a little bit, not because of what Bessent did in a way that it took down the dollar, but as a response to the fact that there's an understanding now that they know that there's fear. They smell it. And there's fear in the air. They're worried that something's going to break. And people are moving to the areas that they believe. People are still buying stocks and all, right? It was a bit of a down week last week, but people are still buying stocks. But the fact of the matter is, where they went for gold, silver, Bitcoin, oil's still moving up, the dollar coming down, all these things right now, very concerning. Now, whether or not that stands up over the test of time, where Bitcoin, I think, was up like 22% in the last week, amazing move. A lot of people on the sideline, they took this as their opportunity to say, wow, we better get out of the way of this. Because they misunderstood the fact that what is happening is the Treasury is really buying the bonds, not the Fed. The Fed takes money, creates it out of thin air, debases the currency, and then buys bonds. That is not what's happening here. The Treasury is taking the short-term notes that they have to that came back, and instead of issuing new ones per se only and then paying back on the short end, they're actually buying on the long end. The idea, again, is to try to control rates. They're not doing a good job of it. Bessent had to come out the next day on Friday and say, well, maybe we'll buy more than $4 billion per month. Yap, 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 yap. Talk, 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 talk. Man, if my parents taught me one thing, it's one thing I'll tell you right now. Talk is cheap. When you say things that are ineffective and hollow, like what we're hearing about the war on a continual basis, like we are in charge of the Straits of Hormuz when no oil and gas are getting out. When why is the oil going up in price? And why has there been estimates over the last number of weeks that we may see $150 oil? Yes, we are long oil in our portfolios. No kidding. We have gold. We have precious metals. We have all of the commodities right now. But the fact of the matter is that when you look at what's going on right now, you look at how they've allowed the strategic reserves in the United States in both Texas and Louisiana to get to critical levels where the storage facilities, which are salt mines, are basically on the verge of potential collapsing because they get all dried out without the excess amount of storage. And then you're going to be ruined. You're not going to have the facilities. You're not going to have the rest of the strategic reserves. Man, what are they thinking? Now, I try to stay out of the politics discussion, but I got to tell you, it's starting to creep into the investments more than I've seen it before in a long period of time. I'm not even go with the fact that the day before, Treasury Secretary Bessent came out with an announcement that the Treasury is going to be buying long bonds. Guess what? Yeah, you guessed it. Huge, abnormally large amounts of TLT, the long bond ETF, were purchased. Who knew what? It's getting messy out there, and that's something that we have to really look at. We'll continue this discussion and probably talk about that on DH Unplugged as well this week. But now, I want to get to our guest. And before we get to our guest, I want to talk to you about Interactive Brokers, because I know that you research your investments, you analyze markets, but have you researched your broker? For the past 3 years, Interactive Brokers' individual clients averaged a 24.3% annual return, beating the S&P 500. Lower costs, competitive rates, and access to more than 170 global markets help investors keep more of what they earn. The broker you choose matters. Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. Learn more at ibkr.com/performance. Visit ibkr.com/performance. I'm going to get to our guest today, and I want to talk to you about who he is because it's kind of important. I've known Ross for many, many years. Great guy. And he, what he says, people listen to. So He is the co-founder, he's the president, he's the CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. And he actually oversees the corporate and investment management operations as well as serves individual clients. He's become one of the most, dare I say, followed investors on social and traditional media. His investment ideas and advice have made him a regular in the business news. He's featured on CNN, CNBC, Fox, Bloomberg, Reuters, you name it, he's been there. He's also a contributing writer for Forbes. He's been ranked as one of the most influential investment advisors and fintech innovators in America. And Ross and the Gerber Kawasaki team oversees well over $1 billion of investments focused on technology, media, and entertainment companies for clients and the firm. Let's get right to it with Ross. So Ross Gerber, it's great having you on as usual. I always enjoy our conversations.
Me too. Me too. I'm glad to be back, actually. It's one of the more fun podcasts that I get to do.
Thanks. You know, I want to talk to you about something because something that's going to tie into our conversation today. I was thinking about this, not just literally just like yesterday. So you're a big music lover. I know that you've been in bands. You play an instrument and all that. Who's your favorite band, by the way? All time.
Well, I don't like that question because my mood changes.
All right.
And I wouldn't think it's fair to say like, oh, the Grateful Dead's the best band of all time, because I would also argue the Rolling Stones could be one of the best bands of all time. If you look at it from like Led Zeppelin could easily be one of the best bands of all time. So if you look at it from the sake of like who wrote the most music that was great, you know, okay, well, all three of those bands are tough to beat, right?
Yeah.
And we didn't even talk about like Prince and some of these other people, which I don't consider Prince a band. Even though it was a band. Then you got the live performance part. Like if you went and saw them, like you could go see the Doors, but they sucked half the time. Like Jim Morrison was like drunk, whatever. I think seeing, and I saw the Grateful Dead many times. So, you know, from that perspective, I think they were one of the best bands you could ever see live. But Led Zeppelin, I think in its day, it was probably the greatest live rock band of all time. Now, once again, I could argue other people too, but for me, I think they were one of the most dramatically powerful bands of all time.
Great band. House of the Holy and all the great songs. Oh. Everybody had Stairway to Heaven as their prom song for many, many years.
I mean, there would be no rock and roll really. They kind of defined the riffs of rock, you know, like Jimmy Page was beyond genius, you know. I mean, every member of the band was beyond genius, and they came together. But if you try to find a bad Led Zeppelin song, like a song you just don't like from Led Zeppelin,
it
doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist. The reason why I ask this, and actually your answer dovetails right into where I want to go with this. My favorite band is Rush, by the way, if you were to name
me down. Oh, I've seen Rush, too. They were great.
I've seen Rush.
I saw Rush in the 80s.
So I saw Rush 90s. I've seen Rush 5 times in concert. And I would keep going, Neil Peart, arguably one of the best drummers ever.
He's amazing.
Top whatever. He passed away. And I said, after that, you know what? I'm not going to see Rush again. How could I see Rush? I feel like it was a betrayal of something. But this is what I'm going to bring up. So I really was absolute about that, right? So I started watching recently this new drummer they brought in. This is this Anika Niels. Oh my God, she's unbelievable. She's unbelievable. And somehow I didn't feel like she was taking.
Are they touring?
Now they're touring. They're touring again. And, and rumor has it, by the way, that they're going to be taking up a residency in the Sphere.
I knew you were going to say that.
In 2027.
They would be a great band for the Sphere.
Great band for the Sphere. Yeah. And here's my point. I would go. So I changed my mind.
I would go too.
So I changed my mind. You changed your mind. And I want to now bring this into the investment world because you obviously said, I'm just going to paraphrase, time and place.
Okay, I just want to tell you, I saw Rush.
Yeah.
Like, this was an incredible thing. I used to call in, you know, to the radios when they would have these promotions in the old days. And I was up early. This was in the early 90s. And Rush was going to play a private show at Tower Records.
Oh, God.
The first 10 people called in. I called in. I freaking won the tickets. I went and I saw Rush at Tower Records.
Wow.
Like this far away. Yeah. It was insane.
I love them. I love them. I have some crazy stories from my time at Rush concerts back in the day. But you've made some changes. Like, for example, when I first talked to you, and I think if my memory is correct, and I don't think this is something to be either embarrassed about or proud of or anything. It's just a fact. I think you're really an Elon lover for very good reason, by the way.
No, I very much, I wouldn't say an Elon lover. I was a Tesla lover.
Tesla lover, but it was attached to.
Elon supporter would be more accurate.
And I think that was, you know, for very good reason and very accurate and very right and very prescient at the time and all that.
Yeah, I made a ton of money.
Ton of money. I know you did. And you've been extremely bullish now, interesting, because there's also a change in your demeanor about some of the things. And I probably was some of the things that happened when he got into the politics and he left Tesla behind, but now you're on the SpaceX wagon, right? And even if you strip away all that, it's your thing is great.
Well, see, I don't think it's fair that because Elon Musk started SpaceX that like everybody else at SpaceX is somehow bad or I shouldn't invest or whatever. Because the truth is Elon does very little at SpaceX. Most people don't know that. We work with lots of SpaceX employees, so I know exactly what goes on at SpaceX. And they're some of the most competent, talented people I've ever met. So that's part of it. My insight into SpaceX is different than maybe what you see on the media side, because the media is always saying, Elon, 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 rockets, Elon. But Elon's like barely does anything there, to be honest. So the people running Starship are amazingly competent. The people running Falcon, you know, so I have yet to meet a SpaceX employee that I didn't think was wildly intelligent and incredibly capable and hardworking. He attracts these people. Mm-hmm. So to Elon's credit, he attracts like hardcore engineers and they do amazing things. So I don't feel as an investor that everybody at that company should now be tarred by Elon's, you know, divisive whatever nature. And at the same respect, we're not buying the stock at this price for clients. I own the stock because I was involved with Twitter 4 years ago, and I'm not selling it because I believe in SpaceX long term. But I am no more of a fan of Musk by any means. You know, like, so I'm not a fan of Steve Schwarzman at Blackstone. I'm not a fan of Mark Zuckerberg at Meta. You know, I'm not a fan of Jeff Bezos at Amazon. I'm not a fan of Tim Cook at Apple. All these guys, like the ethics and the morals of the people running these companies in America suck. So what am I going to own if I'm going to start analyzing CEOs' personal viewpoints? You know, like Tim Cook can't wait to do business with the Chinese military just so the iPhone cost won't go up.
Right.
He's raising the price anyways. Okay. So let's be real, Tim. You don't give a shit. You're just trying to make money.
Yeah.
Okay. But like, I'm thinking what's best for America. Tim doesn't care. He's just trying to make money. You know, Tim Cook, they all play this role. They play this role that they're these like CEOs that are like these nice people. But I've learned this in my life. If you have $1 billion, you prove to me how you are a nice person, okay? Because I don't believe the charitable gifts and the fake bull crap, okay? A lot of these guys got there because they're willing to do what's necessary, and a lot of times what's necessary isn't ethical.
I mean, you could
look at what's happening with the Dodgers right now and the Lakers.
Oh.
Mark Walter.
Yeah.
Okay, this is huge in L.A.
Yeah.
This is huge in L.A. Yeah. right now. We do business with Guggenheim. I've been doing business with Guggenheim for 20 years, let's say. More.
Yep.
Okay. And I've known management at Guggenheim. This is a good firm. Okay. Like they have been a well-run firm for a long time. So these guys broke off from Guggenheim, made a lot of money, and got into the sports business. But they figured out the Warren Buffett playbook. Oh, we're going to buy insurance companies and use the float. But instead of using the float just to invest, they used the float to invest for them and then lied about that it was for them. Okay. And you're not allowed to do that with insurance companies because you're supposed to be safe with the money, okay? So he's got himself into a pickle. So he sells the Lakers, you know, and now he's got everything for sale, you know.
Well, eventually some of this stuff gets caught, but it's not for a while if things are going good, right?
Look at Ballmer and the Clippers. This guy's so corrupt.
there's the what do they say? You know, this kind of situation when you have that much money, or you get the, not everybody, but even you could probably spread this out to, you know, dear old Warren Buffett, how he made his money over the years with, you know, banging on things that were necessary, but yet gouged
about
the
selling
public.
Crappy food and oil.
Right.
You know,
of course,
like Warren Buffett is probably one of the worst people for the health of America. Right. And I've been critical of Warren Buffett for many years, and many of those investments didn't work out for him either. Like Occidental and Kraft Heinz, all the shitty food companies he owns have not worked out for him.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm happy about. Now what does he own? Apple and Google. Okay.
Right.
So, right. You know, like, so Warren Buffett is perfectly happy selling poison to you for sure.
So let's just go back to SpaceX just for a moment, because there's been, you know, I found fascinating during the whole run up to the SpaceX IPO was pretty much that was the entirety of the news cycle. And it's right. I know you were in it, but I'm saying it was almost like, oh my God, that was replaced by the entirety of the news cycle for I don't even know how long it was that we had about the Fed, right? You know, they're going to every single guest on every single show, the question, particularly on CNBC, hey, is the Fed going to raise rates? I'm like, is that all? Who cares what this one individual thinks about the Fed? Unless CNBC is really trying to make what they say the reality. Because that's kind of some of the things that they talk about in the morning, the politics and all that, and bringing everything back.
Financial media does not reach a large audience. No. So, you know, going on CNBC, you could yell fire in the theater all day long. Nobody's running, okay?
Yeah.
So if you turn on CNBC today, that's basically what the guests they choose is people who yell fire in the theater.
Correct.
So
who can come up with
there's no value to CNBC. Like I'm on these shows and they don't ask me as much as they used to. And for whatever reason, you know, it just depends on the producer of the moment. But like, you know, if you look at their content versus like Bloomberg or Fox Business or any of the news networks, it's like, why do I see Tom Lee every day?
Every day. If not him, it's
like every day.
Jeremy
Siegel.
Like
the guy just says the same thing every day. And it's like, well, nobody's saying like a lot of what you're saying is completely wrong. You know, like there was a huge correction in July, for example, or like at the end of last year, you know, oh, Bitcoin's going to this or that. And none of that worked out. You know, he's got this Bitcoin immersion company.
Oh, have you seen the stock there? Oh.
Yeah, so he loses people like 80% and nobody says nothing. Tom Lee just goes on TV, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think discussing interest rates is probably one of the least interesting conversations that the public could want to listen to.
Right.
Discussing what's going on. Like I had a tweet go viral over discussing what's going on with the Lakers and the Dodgers. You know, people care about like that when it comes to business a lot more than they care about what the Fed's going to do, which is nothing, by the way.
Yeah.
The Fed's not going to do anything. So you can talk. You know what you could talk about is the fact the Fed doesn't need to do anything because rates are going up anyways.
Right. Well, he did that, right? I mean, that was, I was actually, just to talk about this rate issue, which may be boring to some people, I was shocked. I mean, not, you know, terminally, but to a point when Warsh came out and said, let the markets do what they're going to do. I'm thinking, oh my God, are you tempting the markets to actually do something? That is probably not in your best interest.
Well, I don't think he came across, you know, like what he wanted it to come across, because the market does tell the Fed what to do.
Yeah, of course.
To be honest.
Yes, of course.
So the market's telling the Fed to raise interest rates by 50 basis points. You know, the 2 years at 4.25. So the 2 years at 4.25 that they should be raising interest rates 50 basis points, maybe 75. But that serves no purpose because short rates don't really matter in the cause and effect of inflation today. So what rates do isn't going to change inflation. What's changing inflation is policy from the government, okay? And so if people want lower inflation, you just got to look at the big orange guy in the White House and say, hey, this is all on you, okay? But the Fed isn't going to stop it, isn't going to help it, isn't going to do anything, and the Fed can't do anything. So markets are also adjusting to the fact that, you know, net savers of money like Google and Meta are now net borrowers,
yep.
So they're competing. So you know, we said it here at the office the other day. Would you rather loan Google money for 5 years or the U.S. government for 5 years? And Google will pay you more.
Yeah.
It just seems obvious that you would buy the Google bond.
Naturally.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep, and so, and that's exactly what's happening. Investors are saying, you know what, U.S., you're not so good anymore. You know, you used to be this, at least the perception of being really solid country and really solid economy and really solid financials, and you'll pay your debts at all costs. And now all the old rules are out and all that. So yeah. You're more like an emerging market now. And now we're paying emerging market rates.
I've always said that we scoffed for years. Oh my God, look at the pigs. Remember that? Look at the pigs. Oh my God. Yeah. They have 120, 150, 200% debt to GDP, right? And then it's like, oh, that's terrible. Now we're the same.
Well, and I want to preface the statement by saying I am not a Democrat. I'm not a fan of politics or either party. So don't attack me and say, oh, the lib hates Trump. I'm just saying from a economic perspective, the policies that this administration have put in are wildly inflationary, have become inflationary, and rates are simply adjusting to it.
Yep.
And if you don't like it, you shouldn't have voted for him.
Well,
okay,
it is like, this is nothing
new. And
we're
going to have another election in 3 months, and America will decide if they want to continue this nonsense where Congress does nothing.
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 No. Yep.
To do what's best for this country. And once again, I don't care if it's a Democrat or a Republican. They're doing nothing to rein in horrible policies that are bad for American consumers and families. And American families are going to show their displeasure in November. That's what's going to happen.
I would tend to agree with you. Hopefully, the fact is that, you know, you have this kind of debt load, which, by the way, hasn't necessarily hurt anybody yet, right?
Right.
We keep on paying everything off, and whether you want to call it MMT, you want to call it some other kind of lucky economics. But now what's interesting, because you touched on this, but we could explore this. One of the things that we liked about the Googles, the Metas, and the Apples and all that was the very little limited debt that they held. And
they had no debt.
No debt to a degree. Enormous free cash flow. Now that dynamic all of a sudden has changed. Are they taking the lead from the government? Like, well, we could have a lot of debt at reasonable rates and nobody seems to care, because nobody seems to care a little bit here and there with the free cash flow has dropped off a cliff for these major companies.
I don't think it's fair to compare the two. And one reason is because the U.S. government can just tax the hell out of us forever.
Or create money.
Okay. Or print money. Yeah, Google cannot per se do that.
Right.
I think for the Googles of the world, investing in the most impactful technology that we've seen, maybe ever, it's really wise, because we're now in an existential battle for who's going to be the Google of the future. Okay.
Yes.
So whatever was up until AI doesn't matter anymore, because if you don't compete for what will be, you will not be there. Okay. It's really simple. I think I tweeted something the other day, because we're working on Claude. We're so ahead in AI at my firm that Claude can't keep up with us. So the issue we're having is that we can't do what we want to do because of actual rules. Like, we can't use client personal data on AI because it's not secure.
Right.
And so we've been working with Anthropic, and other investment firms are working with Anthropic to try to get secure, you know, data centers that are not connected to the rest of the world, so that we can actually run models and things like that on AI, which is going to be a game changer for running financial plans, for example.
Right.
And so we've now got it where we can take your tax returns, your credit card statements, any statement, we just scan it into AI and it builds everything for you. It's fucking amazing.
Right.
The problem is we have to redact everything and we can't use client name, you know, so it's just not scalable. But, you know, they're working on this. They're saying soon. But investing in AI for these companies, you know, I was trying to compare it to, if you imagine an old library that had all the file cabinets and remember all the microfiche that we used to use.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So if you tell a young person like Alex here, who's working here, ask him what microfiche is.
Yeah, no idea.
Alex might know, because he's one of those wise young people.
Yeah.
But we used to actually do research with this shit.
I remember.
Right?
Remember, you had to turn it this way.
They were physical files,
you had to
right?
Turn the wheels on the microfiche.
Yeah, you turn the wheel, and then you find the article, and you push print.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I'd highlight the article where it said this is what's good or whatever. We did this. We spent time doing this at the Penn Library. I spent a lot of time at the Penn Library looking through these stacks of files. So now imagine a data center at AWS. Essentially, a CPU-based data center is exactly the same as the library. It's just files that you've stored onto a server that you can query when you want that file.
Right.
That's basically how modern computing works.
Mm-hmm.
So you go onto the web and you want to watch a YouTube video. That YouTube video sits at AWS in its closet. And when you say, watch me, it comes out of the closet, you watch it, and then it just goes back. That's basically how data centers work today.
Right.
Then AI comes around. Well, what's the difference? When we went from CPUs to GPUs now, well, the GPUs can read the documents and now tell you something about those documents. Well, this is a whole nother thing. So now I've got to take every one of these pieces of data or videos or whatever, and I move them from a CPU-based data center to a GPU-based data center. And once I do that, now I can actually work with these things in real time without just calling it up and back. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So now I can say, summarize these 10 videos for me in a one-page summary. And it can watch all 10 of the videos and then do this for you in a very rapid amount of time. So
it's amazing.
Takes tremendous amount of compute and memory, which they just don't have. So, you know, this is an incredible time for companies to invest as we move every piece of data essentially from a CPU-based data center at AWS to a GPU-based data center at AWS.
Yep.
And that's why this is so lucrative and why there's so much investment and why these companies have negative free cash flow, because if they don't do this, somebody else will.
Right. They call it an existential risk to the company if, in fact, they don't keep up with
100%.
Whatever.
100%. And we've seen this disruption. Where are RCA televisions today?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Where are US cars today? You know, like, you look at the industries we've lost in, you know, one after the next, from TV sets to rare earths to whatever that are made in other places. And so the US understands the value of this technology and said, we're going all in on this. And we're definitely keeping it away from our adversaries as much as possible. And we're going to build these great systems and we're going to invest $1 trillion a year into it.
That's because we learned. But Ross, we learned. We actually created China. We created Vietnam. We created the exporting.
We created Japan. We created Germany.
We didn't want to do any of this stuff, right? We're too good to making T-shirts in a hot factory.
Don't tell the Iranians that if they let us win and let us take it over, they'd all be rich in 15 years like the Japanese. They, you know, Iranians just don't get it.
Nope. But the thing is that we finally looks like we're starting to realize that, and this is a little bit different because it's not a sweatshop in some of these regards. In most of these, obviously, it's more white collar thinking. You know, AI, the technology, you have to be a brainiac to do a lot of this stuff. And it's a little bit different, but the understanding, maybe it took all that to get us here, right? Maybe it took that to bring us to this point where we realize and recognize we got to do this. I mean, we have to keep it here and we got to make sure that we win this race. Let me ask you though, let me kind of go into this discussion about, I think we've talked about this before, and this is the circular financing, the leverage.
Yes, the way this is all going down.
This whole thing is this. There's some weirdness in some of the ways that at the center of it all had been. It may not be really today exactly, but NVIDIA, and they're buying space from here, and then they're getting money back from here, and then they're going back into over there, and the banks are giving them money, and then they're putting money over here, and then Microsoft says, hey, you know what, we're going to invest in ABC AI company. Hey, by the way, they're going to be committing to a five-year deal where they're going to be buying space on our cloud, Azure, and they're going to be paying us $18 million a year or something like that. Meanwhile, we're going to give them X amount of dollars to buy into their company, taking assets off of the balance sheet and turning them into revenue for the income statement.
Right.
Tell me where you are with all this.
So remember the railroads?
Yes.
So when they started, a guy named J.P. Morgan was kind of the banker behind this stuff.
Heard of him.
They needed tons of capital, right?
Yeah.
We've got to lay like metal across this entire country for trade, okay? And it was a huge capital investment. And if you remember, there was probably like 50 different railroads when it started.
Yep.
And they were all short lines, you know? And it was like, how many of them went bankrupt, right? So they were all borrowing money. This was helped build Wall Street. It literally helped build Wall Street. And it was all circular financing because if I didn't like have the end consumers and the end producers of goods on my payroll, like to do, you know, like if there was no reason to take the train, then this is bad. So we want to make sure that all the things make sense so that when we build the train line, it makes sense to do that. So for them to invest in like the real estate around the train stations, and then those people are paying rent back to the train, you know, like, so I get the concern because NVIDIA makes a profit and then funds a startup that will use all of its products. But that's actually how business works. Like, for example, the broker dealers give us money to help us grow for free, basically. If we grow, we get to keep it because it's good for them. Is that circular financing? Absolutely. Like, we just give them back the money, right? In fees.
Yeah, so, I get it. Yeah.
Like, a lot of businesses work this way. Look at the pharmaceutical industry. Like, so many industries work this way where if we make a lot of money, we want to fund customers of our products. Like, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Mm-hmm. So if you look at NVIDIA's portfolio, okay, so NVIDIA is making, let's say, $150 billion a year. They got to do something with it. So they're buying back stock, they're paying dividends, and then they got, let's say, another $50 billion a year to invest.
Right.
Should they just buy Google stock, or should they invest in companies that will materially help their business one way or another? And that's exactly what they're doing. It's called capitalism is what it is. So if you take your capital and you give it to people that help your business grow, it's a very intelligent use of capital versus investing in something that has, like the old conglomerates where now I diversify into a completely, you know, now I'm selling potato chips at NVIDIA.
Right, trucking
we
company,
want diversification, right, yeah. You know, and those conglomerates never held up over time. They always ended up getting bought up and broken up.
Oh, broken up, right.
Because you lose your multiple if you become too complicated, right? So markets like pure plays where they can assign a higher multiple to your growth rate. You know, it's kind of the problem with Disney. They got to get rid of the cable company, like Comcast just did.
Yep.
Get rid of the cable company. All of a sudden, you look like you're growing again. Because you are. It's just you had this one division that sucked, you know?
Right.
So I think I would be more concerned, because I do believe markets work themselves out. I would be more concerned if what they were building didn't have such an immediate return. Okay. So I was just telling somebody this in the office. A data center is better than an oil well. Okay. And in the old days, you put all this capital into the ground and you hit oil and then you extracted money for 25 years.
Right.
Okay. Very capital intensive business, lots of failure. But when you hit it right, boom, you made money for 20 years.
Sure.
Now think of a data center as a piece of real estate. You build a GPU-based data center for $5 billion and you can rent compute. Demand for compute, and right now you can sell your compute for more than it costs you to make compute.
Right.
The challenge is can I build that factory? Not whether the factory will be profitable. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I need power. I need to get approvals from the government. I got to buy land. I got to get equipment from all these companies that don't have equipment. But if I can get this shit together into a box, I can sell compute for a profit, and a very good profit. And CoreWeave has proved this, right?
Yep.
And so that's the beauty of the investment, is when you finish the box and it operates, you make money right away. Where in a lot of companies, like I'll give you Tesla as an example, where they're building robo-cabs and they're putting them in all these cities. Even though full self-driving doesn't work yet, they're still preparing for the day that maybe it'll work.
One day.
And so they're putting all these cabs and they're spending all this money building this system. What they don't know is when they turn it on, let's say it works and they turn it on and now there's 500 cabs in 50 cities in America, and they're all driving around making Tesla money. What we don't know is what can they charge for the rides,
right?
Versus what's the cost? We just don't know that yet. So a lot of people are assuming like what Uber makes on a ride minus what you pay the driver would then be your margin.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge mistake. Okay. When you get in an Uber and there's a human driver, you understand that you're paying that driver. If you get in a Waymo and there's not a human driver, why would the expectation be that it should cost the same? It should cost less.
Correct.
There's no driver.
Correct.
Is that common sense? Yes. Mm-hmm. And so as more cabs come out into the market without drivers, what happens to the price of a ride? It goes down.
Right.
Because we're now competing.
And this is why they're talking about this technology not being disinflationary.
100%. It's wildly disinflationary, right, what's happening with cars, okay? And so the price of a ride right now is $3 or $4 or $5 a mile on Uber or Waymo or any of these, right?
Yeah.
But to be competitive with a car is less than $1 a mile to drive. So you're in this battle of pushing your prices down to get more consumers to take rides. Because if the same amount of people keep taking rides and we add cabs, prices go down. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the way I look at the RoboCab business is it's a race to the bottom. It's opposite of investing in AI, okay?
Yep.
Where I know I can sell my compute for a profit and maybe even a bigger and bigger margin over time because the demand's so big. With robo-taxis, I know the demand is here, but I'm not sure if it grows. And I got many new competitors and technology creating this, you know, disintermediation. And then with that, I get lower prices. So it's great if you're the consumer because now you're like, oh, I can take my Waymo now because my Waymo's $15 instead of $25. But if you're Waymo, what's going to happen is you're going to see ads in the car. That's what's going to happen. So the little screen, you're going to start watching YouTube, it's going to be ads. That's what's going to be because Waymo won't be able to make all their profit just from the ride. It's going to have another source of revenue. And now if I'm not sure where I'm going to go to dinner, it might even make suggestions, you know, and now I'm getting paid like AdWords, right? And so Google has a reason to have cabs. Yep. But if you're just running a cab business, I don't know. I don't think it's good. So everybody's bullish on Uber, the valuation, this and that. I am not at all.
I like the original idea they came up with, which was we're going to have this self-driving, full self-driving, or whatever you want to call it, depending on the company, right? But this concept of an autonomous vehicle, right? This concept that we're not going to need to buy cars anymore. If I do have a car, it doesn't need to sit in my driveway all the time. It can be automatically called up to be a driver all around the place, which would mean that I can make money on it as I'm sleeping in theory.
Do you actually believe that?
No.
Right.
No, I'm just saying that was the...
Well, number one, I'm not giving up my car because I have shit in my trunk right now that I need.
Exactly.
Like my golf clubs or whatever.
Yeah.
And so like, what do I do if I'm not sure if I'm going to play golf today? You know, like I'm not sure. So, you know...
No, I get it.
Do I take my RoboCab to work? Where do the golf clubs go when I get to work? You know, like, I don't know. So I don't see that. And then I always thought the best model was exactly what Tesla was doing, which is building great EVs that could drive themselves. So I love the idea of getting in my car and pushing a button and it drives me completely safely to my destination. I mean, how could you not sell that car?
Right.
Right. Elon thinks that he has this vision of transportation in the future. And you can see it in his Terrafab video. That's basically like the Blade Runner future. It's literally the Blade Runner future.
That's exactly what came to my mind, by the way. Was
right.
Yeah, exactly. As
with
you
those
were talking
cars
before.
And the weird, with the weird, it's like the
fifth
toaster,
element, the fifth element
the toaster thing. Yeah. And so I was like, Elon just watches these movies and then he like wants to create that.
Yep.
But he's forgetting that there's these humans in the way.
Poor humans. I know.
And us humans, we want our own cars. We want different colors. I want to wrap my car with a matte black wrap and a weird rim. If anything people do is customize cars, right?
Right.
Boats and cars. Have you ever been to one of these car things? You know, I'm sure they have them in Florida. You go to these car things and everybody's got their sweet car and customized car out there.
Yep.
I mean, people love these things.
Love
Kids
them.
Love these things.
Love them.
I love them too, to be honest. And it's like, I'm not going to go to a day where everybody has three-color car. We all have a Model Y, and that's how we get through our lives in this weird dystopian world where we all drive in a Model Y that's white. Like, this is like hell to me. That's like hell.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
I'd be running around spray painting the freaking cars, at least so there'd be different ones.
A little something. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to cover a couple of items, so we're going to go quickly through them. Situational awareness. Thoughts on that meltdown?
Oh, I love them.
Is, love them. What do you love about
it? Yeah, it gave me a chance to buy Micron the other month for cheap, and then
you got to look at the fact that Ken Griffin picked it up at a bargain. Or some are even saying he could have done it.
I think he made like $4 billion on that trade.
Unbelievable. But
and I give Ken credit. I Ken's a master, and I give him a lot of credit for being the master of trading. I mean, this guy, between owning 20% of the market and then being allowed to have a hedge fund that trades knowing what everybody's doing, it seems like a wild conflict of interest, right? That some reason the government seems to be fine with all that. That said, I mean, just a masterfully crafted way to
take
this kid's money.
And quick.
It's like a lesson.
Yeah.
It's like a lesson
for
inexperienced people like this Leo Ashen.
But he's still around, by the way, and he's still making trades. He did $400 million.
Well, he won't last. Don't worry. No,
I know that. Yeah, that's clearly. And it looks like he's taking a lot of the playbook.
All the kids at my firm came in with this guy. They came in 6 months ago. Oh, have you been following this guy? This guy's trades. Are we trading in the same shit? I look at his portfolio. It goes, same shit we own.
Right.
I'm
heavily leveraged.
Oh, he's a fucking genius. He owns Micron. Like, same with us.
Yeah.
Okay, it's 6x earnings.
Right.
Like, for some reason, the market doesn't want to believe that Micron's going to sell chips, but they are. So this guy just leverages up 4x on Micron, gets wiped out. I go, is he a genius or a fucking idiot?
Well,
if you're an idiot, trust me, over time, you're just not going to make it.
Yep.
And so the fact that he married the Anthropic woman and has this big Anthropic stake that saved him from going bankrupt,
yep.
He should be very grateful to his wife. And if you looked at the wedding pictures,
I've never seen
a happier man at a wedding. Okay. And when the man is that happy at a wedding, you know something's bad. It's gonna happen.
The wedding was 2 days after he went down in flames. Could you imagine how much? Could you imagine?
Any of this nonsense? Yeah. Can you imagine the idiots that give this guy billions of dollars?
And they keep giving him more money.
Micron position?
25-year-old genius.
It turned out his portfolio is 50% Micron and SanDisk.
Yeah.
Leveraged up 4x. Like, even Kathy Wood, the worst money manager in history, is smarter than
the worst. It's like the Korean market. That's what he did. He just took the Korean market with two stocks. Exactly. Listen, one more thing.
Oh, and then I'm going to leverage up the most volatile stocks, too.
Of course.
Like he's never read a book about the 50% corrections that all tech stocks have,
And semiconductors and that have a definitive cycle over time.
Oh, totally. Well, the worst part is, like, I'm on TV. Like, he could have just called me, let's say, and said, Ross, you've been trading for 32 years. I've been doing this. I got $40 billion in my fund. I need somebody with trading experience to help me.
Yeah.
Maybe he should have just done that, because I would have sat down and in 1 second, I would have made him take that leverage off.
Right.
And I mean?
Would have saved him. Would have saved him.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I was down 5% in July. Okay. I'll take it. And once again, Micron's my top holding. Google's my second top holding. Then I got NVIDIA as my third top holding. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And then I got Broadcom. And then I got Microsoft. So I've got just as much AI as this kid. But I'm down 5% and he's wiped out.
Wiped.
67%.
Last thing I want to talk about, and this goes back to the top of when we talk about being able to change your mind and do things, because this is an important lesson. I don't think the people should take this lightly. A lot of players cannot change their mind things. I mean, really can't. And there's a lot of reasons why, right? There's ego. There's a lot of ego involved.
I think that's the number one reason.
Yeah.
I mean, this happens to me a lot where, I've been saying something on TV. I've been on TV for 15 years. And I was saying something 5 years ago about a stock or whatever, and I was wrong.
Yep.
Okay. And I changed my mind. And it's like, well, people are like, well, Ross, you loved that stock 5 years ago, la, la, la. And they never let you live it down. And right. I was like, dude, I get what I tweeted 5 years ago, but you're skipping tweets for the last 5 years where you can see me change my mind in real time.
But you did change your mind about something, right? Let's talk about
But changing your mind is extremely painful, and they punish you for it. Yep. In public view, but it doesn't stop me. I don't care what the public says. I care what I'm saying. So if my mind has been changed, I that needs to be known.
Right.
And a lot of times my best investments have come this way, where I started not liking something and then people convinced me otherwise, and then I start liking it. Those are some of my best investments. So changing your mind is a very healthy thing, despite the pain of doing that.
You changed your mind about Bitcoin. You know, we talk about the Pied Pipers of this, you know, the guys that are out there.
I wouldn't say I changed my mind. I've changed my attitude.
Okay.
Towards
okay, I'll go with that. You look at Michael Saylor, who, by the way, I've had a 25-year grudge with after he...
Oh, then you'll like me picking on him, huh?
Yeah, it's at least a 26-year issue. Back in the year 2000, when he did a little bit of a... It was my birthday, and I lost 50% of MicroStrategy that I owned because... I don't know if you know this and you knew it back then, but basically the firm was booking service revenue that was 5 years into the future as revenue today, the full booking of it. And it
sounds like Bitcoin.
Oh, it was exactly. So, you know, this whole thing is these Pied Pipers, you know, you got like the Pompliano. I call him Pompliano, right. Not Pompliano.
I know Pomp. Yeah, yep. I know Pomp.
I call him Pump. He's been on the show several times, but, you know, he went from a writer to now he's, I guess, a money manager and just, you know.
Well, now he's got some AI solution for everything.
Yeah. So, but you've changed your mind on or you've changed your attitude on it.
Well, what happened, so fundamentally, I still think Bitcoin is this great idea and concept. And certainly we were talking about government, you know, just complete recklessness with currency and printing money. So Bitcoin does represent something that can have value relative to the depreciation of other currencies. And then you have gold, which essentially functions in the same way, right?
Right.
But a lot of the promise of Bitcoin was that this was actually going to become something that we could use. Like, so it would become something, you know, you can actually use gold, you know, maybe it's not, you don't walk into a store and use gold, like a gold coin. But as I was saying to somebody who was arguing with me, I could easily go to the jewelry district in LA or to any pawn shop right now. There's a pawn shop on 4th Street. A good friend of mine owns it. I could come in with my gold coin and let's say it's worth $4,000 today and he'll lend me $2,000 or $3,000 against the gold coin right now.
Right.
Okay. Can't do. So Bitcoin, I could stake my Bitcoin or all this bull crap and then they all go out of business. So gold and Bitcoin essentially work the same. And I would argue that gold's in some ways even easier to use and more usable in more places. So some of the premise of Bitcoin was supply and demand, which was so many people wanted Bitcoin, but there wasn't an easy way to get it. And then the ETF came out. And when the ETF came out, I was like, all right, now Bitcoin's going to go up because everybody can buy it. Everybody bought it. It went up. And that was great. And then we sort of reached this maximum Bitcoin moment when Trump embraced cryptocurrencies and promised the world and Bitcoin hits 130,000 and everybody's like, Bitcoin's going to be the currency of the world, blah, blah, blah. Well, the problem is, A, they use Trump as their spokesperson. B, they use Michael Saylor as their spokesperson, mm-hmm. right? And C, every exchange owner has gone to jail, okay? Except the Winklevosses. And so, like, you're like, wait, hold on a minute. The only reason these guys are in jail because Trump let them out. Then Trump goes and scams his people out of $4 billion, okay? And he rug pulls them all with his coins. And what does that do for confidence, right? Nothing, right? And then all these people are owning the iBit, you know, ETF. You can't even use the Bitcoin this way. So I'm just betting directionally when I own an ETF that more people are going to have Bitcoin. Well, everybody had Bitcoin. Well, everybody's holding Bitcoin going, why do I own this Bitcoin? And then they got guys like Trump ripping people off. Then you got guys like Saylor who say they're never going to sell a Bitcoin in their life. They're the Bitcoin maximalists. And then he's borrowing money to buy Bitcoin and he's selling stock to buy Bitcoin. And he thinks he's a fucking genius. Okay.
Yep.
Why? Because he's taking $1 billion from other people. That's why he thinks he's a genius. Well, now it reverses on him. So now he's selling, right, Bitcoin to buy cash back. You know, it's like MicroStrategy in reverse. Well, now this unwinds very poorly, you know. So he's just starving off a massive Bitcoin unwinding. And that's why I've changed my attitude on it. Because these guys have leveraged themselves. They've played this game like holding a bunch of dollars in the bank is somehow valuable. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And then Trump's ripping people off and the exchanges are ripping people off. And people just said, we've had enough. We've had enough.
Yep. No, I agree.
And they're buying gold.
Yep.
And, they are buying gold. Buying gold. And what I say to them, and I say, you're right. You are 100% right. I would love to go on a show with a bunch of Bitcoin maximalists today and convince me what's next for Bitcoin. Like, what's next? Where does it go from here?
Well, Ross,
because I would argue it has nowhere to go.
It's just the Bitcoin winter, sir. We've been through these before.
Winter, it's a $60,000 coin that I bought for $500. There's no winter going on.
That's what they talk about.
It's up like thousands of percent, okay? It's wildly successful. Like, I don't understand why people have a problem with it being at 60,000.
I'm just saying, I think they like the volatility, because if you look at the Bitcoin volatility recently, it's been pretty calm, which, by the way, I would present to you as what we want to happen with this.
100%. It's a currency.
Right.
I can't use a currency like the Turkish lira that changes 10% a day.
Right.
Okay. So yes, if I'm an exchange, I want volatility. If I'm a Bitcoiner, I want volatility because I make money off the public this way.
Correct.
But the public wised up.
Yes.
The public doesn't want it anymore. They get ripped off over and over and over again. Yeah. It started with Mt. Gox. I've gone through this over and over and over again with these exchanges. Where the fuck do I even put my Bitcoin that's safe?
That's the problem. I mean, it's only a couple of things.
I don't even trust these hard wallets, you know? Like, so now they're like, oh, and by the way, quantum computing in the next 5 years will break the
algorithm. Bust them all anyway,
now you're really, really screwed, which I don't know if that's true or not. But, like, I'm like, you know, earning 5% interest in a nice, safe bond is not such a bad place to be.
I hear you.
And that's what investors are choosing. We have 0% of clients calling here saying, I want Bitcoin.
There was a moment. But then I can't remember the last time somebody's talked about Bitcoin with me. You know?
Well, I think that, once again, I think part of this is because Trump rug pulled all his supporters.
Well,
out
it's
of
not
$4
only
billion.
Trump. The rug was pulled by a lot of players.
Well, everybody in that administration figured out that if they supported crypto, they could create these coins and soak their supporters. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, it's not like I lost money on a Trump coin. Who bought a Trump coin? Yep. Trump people.
And you don't even get an actual coin.
No, you don't get anything. You got to lose.
Like,
what,
you don't even have like something you know, maybe one day
Trump's
sells.
As rich as ever. You know, like, listen, I'm all for Trump supporters making direct donations to Donald Trump's wealth. I have, if that's what people want to do with their money and give it to Donald, I say you do that.
Right.
You go ahead and do that.
Right.
But that is not what I'm doing with my money.
Yep.
So that said, I think a lot of confidence was lost because people assumed the president was crypto friendly and the crypto people thought that he was crypto friendly, but really he was just scamming them all.
Right. Ross Gerber, always a pleasure talking with you about all sorts of subjects. I'm glad that you have the ability to change your minds. Who knows? Maybe you and I will meet out at the Sphere and see Rush together one day.
I that would be amazing. That'd be great. I like the Sphere, and I'd love to go see Rush with you.
So that'd be great.
When that comes out, you let me know.
I will. All right, buddy. Talk to you soon.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah. And that's going to wrap it up with Ross Gerber from Gerber Kawasaki, talking all things from tech to Bitcoin to what's going on in politics, also AI, what's happening with SpaceX, Tesla. Man, there was a lot of ground that we covered right there, so that was pretty awesome. I want to thank you for joining me this week, every week. Of course, you can go to listen to this directly by subscribing. And I'd appreciate it if you do. It's always good for us. You can go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, YouTube, iHeartRadio. This is the list goes on and on and on. Plus, all the podcast apps that are out there also have availability of not only the Disciplined Investor podcast, but DH Unplugged. And actually, yeah, DH Unplugged is moving along right now. We're still working out the kinks. Still trying to decide exactly what's happening, but some of the formatting that we're doing and changing, I think are pretty cool. So I hope that you are going to be able to, listen to that and spend some time with that. Until next week, I bid you adieu. I think Tom Nelson from Franklin Templeton, and we're going to be talking about a lot of things. I have so many questions about how to actually create a portfolio based on asset allocation and diversification, because we talk about that all the time, but we won't ever get down to it. So I think I'm going to put a slew of questions together to ask him that. And of course, if you want to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, find out more about what we do for clients and how we can help you with your investments, with your estate plan, with your financial plan, all that's good stuff. Go over there right now. Click on a button. There's any button in the contact us area, and we'll make sure to get back to you. Talk directly to you. I will talk directly to you. I can promise you that. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again real soon. podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.